This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, if you think this past winter, assuming it's really past, was tough on you, then think about what it did to our lawns and golf courses, and even the turf in Spartan Stadium or at Comerica Park. Let's ask good friend and frequent guest Kevin Frank about last winter's impact on our turf. Kevin's an associate professor in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences at Michigan State University and also an MSU Ag Bio Research Scientist. Kevin, it's always a hopeful sign when we can talk to you about spring and turf.
I'm with you. I hope it is finally spring.
Well, this last winter was obviously a brutal one. What kind of an impact did it have on our lawns and golf courses?
Yeah, it was certainly very challenging, not only for us to survive, but apparently turf grass too. The biggest damage that we've seen is on golf courses, especially in southeast Michigan. A lot of our golf courses, especially that grow annual bluegrass or poannual putting greens, you know, the older courses that are often some of our most fabulous playing surfaces, they really took it hard this winter. We had ice that was basically like a skating rink sitting on top of many of our putting greens for over 2 months, and that really resulted in widespread turf loss on a lot of the putting greens on the golf courses. So for the golf course, it's been very tough, and it's still tough. Many of them are probably not going to be able to play their greens possibly until early June.
Wow, because they've got to do so much replanting.
You're essentially, and some of these greens I've visited, you're starting over. I mean, there's literally hardly, you know, maybe there's 10% of the green that's alive. So it's basically reestablishing the whole putting green. And, of course, you can't really do that effectively if you have people putting and playing on it all the time.
So these golf courses will obviously be communicating, if they're private, to their members, if they're public, they'll be putting out the information.
Yeah, there is a common term that most golfers don't like to hear. Temporary greens is becoming very much in play this year.
What is that? Is that artificial turf?
Well, no, that's basically you maybe mow down the fairway a little bit lower in a circle and put a flag stick in the cup, you know, 20, 30 yards in front of the green. That's what you play. You know, and that's
kind of like playing in Scotland almost.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the only option we have on some of these facilities. Is if they want to be open at all, they're going to have to be on temporary greens. Hopefully, most facilities have, you know, to be honest with you, some of the courses I've visited, they're lucky if they have 9 greens that they might be able to play on and 9 temps. So, you know, for the golfers, it's a matter of being patient, because what I've tried to tell them is, you know, if you can sacrifice a little bit of time right now, hopefully we'll have good surfaces to play on by the time we get to June, July, August, and September.
You know, Kevin, last year we talked, it was a fairly normal winter, but before that we had that freeze in April that really decimated a lot of fruit crops. And now this year, is the normal the new abnormal now? I mean, it's really difficult to predict, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, this winter, if we went ahead ice, I don't think our golf courses would have been hurt. Now, our lawns are a different story when it comes to the amount of, you know, I think almost everybody broke snow cover records or snowfall amount records in one way or another this year. And as you look at your lawn in the last probably 2 weeks, many people might have wondered what the heck happened. And there's a lot of snow mold out there, both pink and gray snow mold. You know, for the average person, it doesn't really matter which one it is. It basically results in the turf looking very matted, might look grayish and or pinkish cast sometimes.
I've got that, actually. And I had no idea what that was.
Yeah, and that's just snow mold. And it usually on our lawns doesn't actually kill the plant. It just pretty much blights all the leaf tissue. So if you're ambitious and want to get some weekend activity for the muscles going early this spring, go out there and just grab a leaf rake and try to stand some of it up. It'll help the soil warm up a little bit sooner, maybe get the grass resuming
growth.
Just
basically fluff it up in those spots.
Yeah,
right?
Fluff it up. What I try to tell people is don't try to mow it all off or mow really low, because in many cases it's so matted, I mean, you'd have your mower deck literally resting on the soil surface probably. So if you can, just be patient. You know, even though the calendar tells you what day it is, we're almost, I think, in some cases, 3 weeks behind, maybe almost a month behind of normal growing conditions.
Well, what other things, what other impacts did this winter have on, for example, grubs or other aspects of our lawns?
You know, I'm not sure it had any impact on any of the insects from what I've heard from talking to the experts, because they said in many cases we went into winter pretty well. You know, we hardened off, it got cold, and then we got the really extreme weather. One thing a lot of homeowners have probably noticed is voles with a V. Essentially, like, similar to a field mouse, tunneling under the snow and, you know, leaving these tunnels where there's grass clippings laying and everything. And though they usually don't kill the turf, they just ate all the grass, the blades. So for most folks, you know, even if, once again, grab your rake, you want to rake some of that dead clippings out of there, but those areas will recover. Some have also said that they've had quite a bit of mole activity early this spring, which, you know, I don't think that's any different than any year. The moles wake up just like we do and they're ready to go.
My guest is Kevin Frank. Kevin is an associate professor in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences at Michigan State University. What about some other things that maybe because of this winter that we don't normally have to do with respect to our lawns, Kevin?
You know, this time of year, with respect to like that snow mold issue and things getting off to a slow start, even if you don't normally apply fertilizer in the month of April, this might be a year when you want to consider that. Because, I mean, looking at my own little patch of green outside my back door, it is struggling. I mean, there was a lot of snow mold injury on it, and I think I'm probably going to have to feed it a little bit to help it along in the next couple weeks. So that's one thing to consider. Another thing is anybody that's looking to prevent crabgrass, you know, using that crabgrass pre-emergence herbicide, we're probably right about in the sweet spot right now for that. Usually, in some parts, of especially southeast Michigan, you might have looked at that even a week or two ago. But with the delay this year, we're still in that opportune time when you can apply that and have it be affected.
You know, Kevin, one thing that we always talk about during your visits, but when people are doing some of these applications, I mean, it's important to be good environmental stewards as well. You always have a lot of good tips on, you know, how can you be a good steward of the environment but also ensure that you have a healthy lawn?
Yeah, best thing you can do, you know, a couple basic tips. Anything you apply as far as a granular, don't get it on your sidewalks or your driveway or throw it into the street. Keep it on the turf grass. If it does get on a hard surface, make sure to sweep it up or vacuum it up or however you want to try to approach it to get it back onto the turf grass. When it's on the turf grass, there's very little risk that it's going to be any sort of contaminant to the environment. But if it gets on a hardscape, as soon as you get a rainfall or irrigation event, it washes it right down the street into the sewer, which goes to one of our bodies of water. So we always want to be careful about that. Other approaches basically are make sure you read and follow the label directions. Whether you're applying a herbicide or whether you're applying a fertilizer, you know, if you buy the bag that says it covers 5,000 square feet and you have a 2,000 square foot lawn and you apply the whole thing,
then you're
you know, you're kind of applying more than you need at that case. So make sure you follow label directions. Another thing I often tell folks is, you know, make a realistic assessment of how good your spreader is. I mean, sometimes our spreaders, just like everything else, they wear out. And unfortunately, I've seen some spreaders that people use to apply products, which almost get down to the point where they have two settings, one being on and one being off.
And so there's no calibration.
Yeah,
whatsoever.
There's really no fine dial point anymore. So, you know, maybe it's an investment you make this spring if you need a new one.
We like to get into this topic because I know you're a big Spartan fan just like I am, but what kind of an impact would this kind of a winter have on the turf, for example, at a Spartan Stadium or down at a Comerica Park? Any different than any place else?
Yeah, you know, the fortunate thing, especially for like Spartan Stadium, is our first football game isn't for a while yet. So, yeah, fortunately for both those teams, I know at Comerica Park they resodded this spring, so they kind of wiped the slate clean, so to speak, and started over. But like in Spartan Stadium, it's basically, you know, it's a Kentucky bluegrass field, and fortunately Kentucky bluegrass is one of the most cold hardy and survive ice and everything else, low temperatures grasses that we have. And so, you know, it might not look perfect right now, but I don't expect any problems as you get down the road.
I wonder if Tom Izzo knows that we have Kentucky bluegrass on our football stadium.
He may not need to know that. Yeah, exactly.
Kevin, as always, where can folks go to get information on what to do with their lawns? I know you have some wonderful educational materials.
Sure. I mean, kind of our landing point for most of the homeowner information is just www.turf.com. www.msu.edu. And there's some other links there to disease identification, weed identification websites, and an insect identification website, which will be online soon. So that's kind of the landing point to go from there.
Yeah, excellent educational materials, and I know a lot of people who use them. I've been talking with good friend Kevin Frank. Kevin is a frequent guest on this program, a turf expert at Michigan State University, whose research is funded in part by MSU Ag Bioresearch. Kevin, always great to see you.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment. This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, as we look back on all the wonderful Earth Day 2014-related activities around the United States and the globe, it seems most apropos to welcome back to the show Hugh McDermott, the very busy and very talented communications director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Hugh, before he joined the Michigan Environmental Council for 22-plus years, was a reporter and columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Hugh, good to see you again.
Thanks a lot, Kirk. It's good to be here.
For those out there who may not be aware of your organization, the Michigan Environmental Council, you've got a lot of members, you do a lot of things, but give us a snapshot.
Yeah, the Michigan Environmental Council was formed in 1980 to be kind of the eyes and ears in Lansing and at the state capitol for the environmental community in Michigan. We have about 60 or 70 member organizations. We don't have individual members. We're not grassroots. And those organizations are some of the big players that you hear of, Sierra Clubs and Clean Water Actions, and also a lot of smaller groups spread throughout the state from the Upper Peninsula to the Ohio border. And a lot of these groups don't have the staff or expertise to keep track of what's going on in Lansing and the governor's office. So we do that for them. We track good and bad legislation, and we work in work groups and administrative details to try to essentially get good laws for the environment and our natural resources passed and kill bad ones.
Well, it is an impressive list of members, and I like the way you can go on your website and click on a map of the state of Michigan, and you can see the different members of the different regions around the state of Michigan.
Yep, yep. We have different members with different priorities, but what we have in common is trying to protect the natural resources that make Michigan such a great place.
Well, some of your key priorities are ones that we cover frequently on this show. They range from clean energy to environmental justice. The one, though, I wanted to ask you about, mm-hmm. which we don't see all the time, but one of your priorities is Michigan environmental history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've done some work on collecting and archiving the environmental history of Michigan. We've done a little bit of work with some key environmental trail, I think it's called, or the natural history trail of some of the landmark environmental places along the Detroit River and some other places where some environmental cleanups and some environmental victories took place. So we try to do a little bit of that, and we work with the Library of Michigan to try to archive some of the materials that are important to Michigan's environmental history.
Well, Michigan, as most of us know, Michigan has a proud environmental history, but one area where Michigan hasn't done so well is recycling. Mm-hmm. Are we going to do better in that, Hugh? It looks like we're making a little bit of progress.
Well, if you asked me a couple months ago, I would have said no. We're still stuck in this moribund state of the state really not caring about recycling. But in the last few months, there's been a lot of progress, led by Governor Snyder, in really moving Michigan forward on recycling. And it's really heartening to see that he's put some resources, including about $1.5 million, toward that effort, and that we're actually going to get some progress. Because for many decades, Michigan has not done anything on recycling. Essentially since the bottle bill in the mid-1970s, late 1970s, there really hasn't been much.
And we were a leader in that bottle bill legislation.
We were a leader in the bottle bill. I remember when I wrote for the Free Press, and this must have been 10 years or more, I did a tongue-in-cheek story about the state's recycling office, which consisted of one fellow in a cubicle in the basement of a state office building, and that was the recycling headquarters for Michigan. And it's sad that 10 years, 12 years later, that's still the case. But with the governor's announcement earlier this week, that's going to change pretty dramatically, and we're looking forward to it.
Well, we've talked to people with the Michigan Recycling Coalition as well, and they're extremely pleased. Yeah. I think they would be in the same boat that you are. They were getting pretty frustrated up until 2 or 3 months ago.
Yeah, Michigan Recycling Coalition is actually one of our member groups, so we work together with them. And you know, the governor has called for doubling the state's recycling rate to about 30%. They estimated at 15% now, but nobody really knows. That's just right. An estimate because nobody tracks this stuff. So just tracking it is progress, and just hiring some people to figure out what we're recycling and what we're not is good progress. So that's really a good. You know,
and in addition to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in addition to the tracking, there's a major education outreach component to this initiative.
Yeah, my understanding is they're hiring about 3 people to join Matt Flechter, who's been in that lone cubicle for a long time, working on market development, public relations, and outreach to local recycling authorities throughout the state. And I read that the governor estimated that there is more than $400 million worth of recyclable material that ends up in landfills or incineration, and that's really an economic opportunity for Michigan that I think can be leveraged for the good of the state.
Have you found over the years with the Michigan Environmental Council, Hugh, that once you link economic advantage to environmental sustainability, then things really start to happen?
Yeah. I mean, we try to do that as much as we can. You know, the environment, our natural resources, whether it be, you know, our forests that are timbered, our recycled materials that we're currently throwing away, and various other things. You know, there's economic value to everything in nature, and it's sometimes harder to make that connection than it should be. But we try to point out that, you know, not only is it often a direct economic benefit, but it's also a quality of life benefit that feeds into you know, attracting people, entrepreneurs, and other people who want to work and live here.
My guest is Hugh McDermott, and he is the communications director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Everybody's talking about the roads. That's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. I mean, everybody agrees that our roads and infrastructure in Michigan are largely a mess. When we're doing work, though, to improve that, we've got to do it in an environmentally sustainable way.
Right. You know, everybody agrees the roads are a mess and we want to fix them. And that's one area where even conservatives are willing to maybe ante up a little money because they understand this is, you know, not only an inconvenience for all of us, but it's also an economic anchor on Michigan when people don't want to come here and do business because, you know, the roads are crumbling. But yes, we would like to see the roads fixed, but we would like to see that kind of work going forward with an emphasis on what we call complete streets, which is the roads and the transportation network in Michigan has to be more than just moving as much traffic as we can, as fast as we can. It has to enhance the quality of life. And if that means bike lanes in certain areas, if that means slowing down traffic in some parts of downtowns where it's advantageous for pedestrians and healthy, vibrant downtowns and communities, then we need to do that. So we'd like to look at the roads a little more comprehensively than just patching potholes or resurfacing highways.
We've talked to some engineering firms on this program about this notion of complete streets, and they seem to think that Michigan is at a really good place right now to begin doing some of that because of all the infrastructure repairs. But pedestrians can walk the streets as well as bikers, et cetera. So it sounds to me like you're on the same page with some of these more progressive engineering companies.
I mean, the best place to construct complete streets and make them safe and accessible for walkers and bikers and shoppers and you know, the disabled community and you know, improve bus lanes and public transportation is when you're rebuilding or building new roads, you know, because it doesn't make sense to tear something up and rebuild it if it's in fine condition. But since many of our roads are in poor condition, when we tear them up, we should be looking at how they fit in to the entire community and not just traffic volumes and speeds.
And a corollary to roads and highways for automobiles, but we've got this initiative now in the state of Michigan to become the trail state, mm-hmm. linking all of these wonderful trails that we have together, the Tart Trail up in Traverse City, for example, on down. I would imagine the Michigan Environmental Council is very pleased with that one.
Yeah. I mean, we have one of the nation's best trail networks already. The governor has indicated that he is supporting building more and promoting our trail network more. And that's really one of the great untold gems of Michigan, I think, is that we have this trail network that you can get on a bike and go for days camping or stopping in communities and staying in bed and breakfasts and do the same thing hiking and walking. And I think that a lot of people, even inside the state, don't know what a great trail network we have. We have, you know, several member groups that are dedicated to trail networks, and we have some political leaders who are beginning to recognize that this all feeds into that quality of life I was talking about, where, you know, you think of Denver, Colorado, you think of mountains and outdoor recreation. You don't necessarily think of that in Michigan, but we should, because we have the greatest freshwater resource in the world, and we have this great trail network winding around them. So let's make use of it and make it a win-win. And package it with the Pure Michigan idea to let people know what we have here.
Let's switch from Pure Michigan and our trails. So what about progress on the renewable energy front? How's Michigan doing?
Yeah, Michigan's doing great. In 2008, we passed the renewable energy law, which required 10% renewable electricity by 2015 and also energy efficiency savings. Our utilities are on track to meet those goals next year, and they are meeting them at costs that nobody envisioned in 2008 would be as low as they are. I mean, we're talking about contracts for wind energy coming in at well below $50 per kilowatt hour, I think. Anyway, it's at a rate that's far below any other competitive electricity source.
Far below what was anticipated.
Yeah,
even.
Far below what was anticipated. So, the governor last year convened a series of meetings and fact-finding sessions where his administration concluded that moving our renewable electricity standard up to 30% from 10% is easily doable by 2035 without any technological barriers. So we're looking forward to the governor's recommendations to the legislature, which we don't expect will come until after the election in November. All indications from him is that he wants to see it increased. We're just hoping he'll be really aggressive about it, because this is a win for the ratepayers, it's a win for the environment, and it's a win for the economy of Michigan, because we're keeping that money in state with wind farms and solar panel installers rather than sending it out of state to import more coal.
I'm talking with Hugh McDermott, who is the communications director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Hugh, you anticipated the next part of my question. We've heard so much about wind, and it's been in the papers and sometimes controversial, but solar sort of fallen off the radar screen a little bit in Michigan, but I notice mm-hmm. some solar companies are doing very, very well on the stock market. So solar is still big in lots of parts of the United States. How about in Michigan?
Yeah. Solar works in Michigan, and we anticipate that solar will be a bigger mix of the renewable energy portfolio in the future for a number of reasons, including the technology, which is just advancing by leaps and bounds, and the solar films and the solar panels are becoming much more efficient and also much less costly as time moves forward. So we anticipate that solar will be part of the mix in Michigan, a bigger part of the mix. And again, the question is not whether we're going to go solar or go wind or natural gas. You know, the question is what percentage of our portfolio, much like an investment portfolio, should solar be, and should wind be, and should coal be? And the answer to that question is different depending on who you're talking to. But clearly, I think it's becoming more and more it's becoming harder and harder to argue that renewable energy is shouldn't be a bigger part of our mix in Michigan.
Speaking of that portfolio, where do you see biofuels?
Biofuels, now we're switching sort of from the electricity generation to replacements for fossil fuel and
right.
oil and gasoline and things like that. And I'm really not that up to speed on biofuels. We have had some stops and starts in that area, including the ethanol, which sounded like a great idea. And in practice, there were a lot of pitfalls to it. So we're learning as we go along. But again, the technology in that area is also growing by leaps and bounds. And, you know, sometimes the reality drives the technology. So we have people looking at how, you know, what a great success wind has been in Michigan, and looking at other opportunities, and biofuel certainly is one of those.
Hugh, earlier in the interview, you gave the governor a pat on the back in terms of the recycling initiative. We also talked about the trails initiative.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard from a couple of listeners about one, though, that they're not too happy with, and that's over in Saugatuck, where some of that shoreline over there is going to be developed commercially. Michigan Environmental Council been involved with that?
Yeah, we've been involved in not just that particular project, but also in dune protection statewide. And we have some real concerns about what's happening with our sand dunes. To set the stage, our freshwater dunes are very globally rare. You don't find freshwater dunes like Michigan has in very many places in the world. So it's really part of pure Michigan, and it's really something worth protecting in Michigan. And, you know, we have iconic places like Sleeping Bear, but in some of the other places that are less protected, the legislature has been chipping away at the Critical Sand Dunes Act and many of the sand dune protections that were landmark passed in the 70s and the 80s. And we're seeing the result of that now, is that developers are getting a free hand to ram roads through dunes and permanently alter the shoreline in many places where it really shouldn't be altered. And the experience in Singapore is one of those. We had a victory earlier in the year where we got the DEQ to deny a quarter-mile road that was going to go through a township sand dune preserves in West Michigan. But this particular one, the Singapore Dunes Project, it's a two-mile road through the Saugatuck Dunes. The science says this will cause irreversible damage. The administration saw fit to approve that. We oppose that. But we predicted this when the legislature opened the Pandora box by chipping away at the Critical Dunes Act. And, you know, it's they didn't discard the whole thing, but it's sort of a death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
And we're going to see more of it if the public doesn't rally in support of the dunes.
Okay, well, I'm sure that you'll keep us posted on your website. My guest has been Hugh McDermott, the Communications Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks so much, Hugh.
Thank you, Kirk.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes. Cameron Davis oversees the EPA's Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and Central Michigan University oversees a $10 million EPA grant to conduct Great Lakes wetlands restoration and preservation research. Mr. Davis was recently at CMU to speak at the Great Lakes Science and Action Symposium. Cameron, welcome to the program.
Russ, thanks for having me. This is really great.
What was your message that day, your key messages when you addressed the symposium at CMU?
Yeah. Well, for one, the more we follow the science, the more we'll understand the Great Lakes, and the better we'll be able to protect the Great Lakes. You know, when you live in Michigan, you cannot help but care about these magnificent water bodies that we have. And we all know that the economy of this state, the economy of this region, is very much linked to the health of these lakes. So making sure we know what's going on with them, making sure that we're making the best decisions that we can to protect and restore them is the name of the game. And I think that's one of the messages. You know, the other one is just urgency. The Great Lakes seem big, but they're incredibly fragile. And we have a lot of work in front of us to try to make sure that we keep them in balance, so we keep them healthy for all of us to enjoy and future generations too.
And when we talk about coastal wetlands, Cameron, what exactly do we mean? How are they different from interior wetlands?
Yeah, right. Well, wetlands play a vital role. These are marshes and bogs and fens and things like that, where the water meets the land. And just like the name, they're wetlands. They are incredibly important for a whole bunch of reasons that often get overlooked. One of them is that they help reduce flooding. And as we all know, the upper Midwest has seen a whole lot of flooding in recent years. Wetlands help buffer against that. They also are filters, and they help improve water quality. And then, last but not least, they also provide habitat for fish and wildlife. And, you know, if there's one thing that we know about Michigan, like the other upper Midwestern states, there's a very strong culture of outdoor recreation, hunting, fishing, things like that. And wetlands really help support those activities. Coastal wetlands are very important because they help the health of the Great Lakes very directly. They can help buffer when it comes to waves and energy and big storms. They also help filter water in the Great Lakes proper. So we need to make sure that we're bringing those coastal wetlands back, and Central Michigan University is playing a really important role in doing that.
And Cameron, what are some of the specific research initiatives the project at CMU will fund?
Well, what they're doing doing. It's really fascinating stuff. They're basically using satellite imagery to better understand where coastal wetlands are, where they may have been, where they're threatened. And all of that information will help us make better decisions on how to better protect and better restore coastal wetlands in the future all around the Great Lakes.
Cameron, how does this work interface with some of the other Great Lakes Restoration Initiative projects?
Well, it's really tied together. You know, one of the things that we are trying to do, you know, the team within EPA, and I'm just one of many good people doing good work on this stuff, other departments like the Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife Service, USGS, and many others, NOAA, for example, it helps in that one of the key pieces of the President's Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is better protecting and restoring habitat, especially wetlands, for all the reasons that I mentioned. And the speech that I gave really helped in terms of articulating why these things are so important and the role of the CMU project to help with that. We're also trying to clean up toxics in the Great Lakes, for example, toxics in the Saginaw River area. Just to give one example, we're also making sure we're combating invasive species, reducing phosphorus that causes harmful algae, and then trying to track all that good work to make sure we can keep making better decisions with the taxpayers' money.
Cameron Davis is with me on Greening of the Great Lakes. He's with the Environmental Protection Agency, and he oversees what's very important to us in the region, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And Cameron, in general, how is the initiative working, and kind of what's its future? How do you see it evolving?
Sure. I think it's working very well. We know we can always do better, and we always strive to get input on ways that we can make it go better. And in terms of the future, Russ, the White House announced about a year ago that it was committed to another 5 years of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. This is a program that has incredibly strong bipartisan support on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and that's important these days. We want to make sure that people are seeing the results of the work from this restoration initiative. We want to make sure that people see where the work is being done and that it benefits everybody. So for those of us who know that the economic health of the region is really tied to the Great Lakes, we also know that a program like this is a really important reinvestment in the region. You know, just like you try to make sure that you reinvest in your home so that it can continue to take care of you, we need to reinvest in the Great Lakes so that they can continue to take care of us.
Hear, hear. Cameron, what's your take on the recently released Army Corps of Engineers study on alternatives for protecting the Mississippi and Great Lakes basins from invasives like the Asian carp?
Sure. Well, we know that there are a lot of ways invasive species can get into the Great Lakes, and they can go from the Great Lakes to other places as well. And one of the vectors, as we call them, one of the pathways is through these connecting channels. The Chicago Area Waterway System is one of those connecting channels. It's not the only one, but it's one of the more important ones that we have. I think that the study helped to start the dialogue on where we need to go in order to do even better in keeping Asian carp from becoming established in the Great Lakes. Nobody wants to see those things get into the lakes. Nobody. But making sure that we have a long-term plan for preventing that from happening is really key. And there's a lot more work that needs to be done on that. I think it's going to be incredibly complex to look at engineering a place like Chicago so that we can reduce those risks.
Cameron, we've just touched on a couple of the very important issues that affect our Great Lakes. There are many. What kind of keeps you up at night? What concerns you the most? And at the same time, what are you most optimistic about moving forward?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's a complex program, and so making sure that everybody's working well together is really key. We've got states. We've got, you know, the governors are behind this program. We've got tribes. We've got cities that play a very important role, conservation organizations, businesses, things like that. The more that they're pulling together, the better this program works, and making sure that keeps happening. What I'm really optimistic about, Russ, is that this program, the President's Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, has such strong bipartisan support. And as long as that's the case, and as long as it is showing results like it is, I think that the program can continue to do what it needs to do to keep the Great Lakes healthy and, therefore, the region's economy healthy.
And, Cameron, lastly, you know, sometimes these problems seem so big for most of those joining in on our conversation, but are there a couple of ways you can suggest that each of us in our daily lives become better stewards of our precious Great Lakes?
Sure, you bet. There are so many ways, but you know, I'll just tell you, as a father of two young kids, it's, you know, we all have busy lives. I know how that goes, and it's not always easy to just think about what can I do today. If you're a farmer, if you're an agricultural producer, making sure that you're keeping your soil and your fertilizers, your nutrients on the land and not letting that run off is very important for places like Saginaw Bay, which has been hit hard by harmful algae. If you are, for example, somebody who gets out and hunts and fishes, helping to support habitat restoration is really important. Supporting the program, the Great Lakes Restoration, is critical, and you can learn more online at GLRI, stands for Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, .us. And then watching how we use our water. Water is our lifeblood around this region. You know, there are places out west like you know, Colorado that have the Rockies. Places like Florida have the Everglades. We've got the Great Lakes. And tending to our water is really, really important. So those are just a few that come to mind.
Cameron, thanks so much for joining us today on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks so much, Russ. It was a pleasure.
Cameron Davis oversees the EPA's Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and you can keep up with him on Twitter at Cameron Davis EPA.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go Green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network. People who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
A number of organizations committed to environmental, economic, and social sustainability in Detroit have collaborated on a recently released Detroit Environmental Agenda. And here to tell us more about it is Guy Williams. Guy is the president and CEO of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice, one of the organizations responsible for developing the agenda. Guy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kirk. Glad to be here.
Before we get into the agenda, tell us a little bit about Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice.
Well, Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice, commonly known as DWEJ, You might imagine why. We are the first environmental justice organization in the state of Michigan. We started out in 1994, and we've been active on a wide variety of issues over the last 20 years, And I'm really happy to say that in this point in time, there are also several other organizations now at the state level and in the city in Southeast Michigan who also have taken on environmental justice issues of different types, everything from air quality, water quality, the right of public engagement and decision making. There's a great array of activity and support and interest in our issues these days.
Guy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I really like the concept of environmental justice, and we don't hear that terminology as much as when we're talking about sustainability and triple bottom line. But it really includes a huge dimension of social sustainability, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the challenges for us in the Detroit area is it's the benefit of having been the home of the Industrial Revolution has had obvious benefits economically and for the whole country. However, the more we start to learn about those industrial processes and the chemicals involved and the distribution of those chemicals, we're now finding there's a double-edged impact to that prosperity, and that there's been a lot of detriment to our land, to the health of our citizens. And this is at the essence of the environmental justice movement, is that we've found that nationwide and even worldwide, there's a disproportionate impact of poisons on people of color. And given the demographics of Detroit, we're somewhat of a poster child for these challenges. But yet in 2014, I feel we're also poised to be a poster child for how to grow and respond and bring resolution to these challenges.
One specific, and as we were talking before we started the interview, one of the specifics when you're talking about people of color being more prone to some of this environmental injustice, the lead situation, the lead poisoning situation among children in the city of Detroit. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the things that DWJ is focused on is we have a vision of Detroit becoming a global model for how all people can thrive in environmental, economic, and social health. And a big part of that is being cognizant and aware of what barriers there are to us achieving that kind of vision. So we know that in the city of Detroit, we have by far the highest concentration of children in the state who've been impacted by elevated lead levels. And what that means is that you have behavioral issues, you have potentially lower IQ and learning disabilities. There's a whole raft of challenges, and even some of the crime rate can be attributed to lead poisoning as a young person. So a lot of our work as an organization and many around the state has been to address the education and how to protect children from lead. It's in the homes, it's in the dirt. It's very prevalent still, but there are ways to get at it. And so there's a lot of progress been made over the last 15 years in particular.
And there's a lot of demolition going on in Detroit of abandoned properties and what have you. And apparently, if you don't do demolition properly, you use standard demolition practices that can also release toxic substances like lead.
Oh, absolutely. Asbestos and lead are one of the largest physical concerns in terms of the environment and the air quality around demolition. So it's a concern of our coalition of advocates for healthy practices that now that the city has funding to ramp up and accelerate the demolition of abandoned homes, we feel that on the positive side, this is going to be a great boost to safety and walkability of neighborhoods and creating confidence for young people to travel to school and be safe, things like that. On the other hand, we want to make sure that the techniques that are applied on such a mammoth scale are also just as safe and healthy and protective of the population.
My guest is Guy Williams. He's president and CEO of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice, DWEJ. Guy, tell us a little bit about, it's been a couple years in the process, but the Detroit Environmental Agenda.
Oh, I'm glad you asked about that, Kirk, and I'm very pleased to be able to talk about it. If you don't mind, I'd like to give a shout out to the website, because it's active. We want people to download it and be aware and really take part in the transformation of the city. The website is DetroitENV.org. And basically, it's been about a 2.5-year process that started with an environmental summit, which was originally conceived as part of the Detroit Future City process. And we had about 200 people come out and talk about the key issues in their parts of town around all aspects of environment. And then we've had a steering committee that's worked with those outputs from that summit and crafted an agenda, and it's been repeatedly vetted with a wide range of organizations and individuals of all levels of the public, specialists, academia, business sector, community organizers, elected officials. When you look at it, we have a very long list of folks that we vetted this with. And then last summer, we used it as a platform for engaging all the elected positions for Detroit, the city council and the mayor's office. And we had a very strong response, positive response, and we engaged in activities in all 7 districts. And the data is actually broken out by district in the report. So we wanted to make sure that people understood that a city as large as Detroit, there's differential around the types of impacts that are going on environmentally and the types of opportunities that there are all across the city. It's not just one monolithic set of problems or issues. So we're very excited that now that the new officials have been elected, we have a new mayor, we have a new city council, and we've begun talking with those folks about how to step forward and implement a lot of the elements of the vision and the agenda.
I did read the executive summary, and you're absolutely right about the website. It's a very interesting and easy to navigate website. But the agenda covers most of the major issues that you could imagine when it comes to clean air, clean water, healthy land, healthy housing. You had a recent meeting with Detroit City Council, and that went very well as well, right, Guy?
Oh, absolutely. I've been working in the city literally 20 years. This week is the anniversary of when I moved to Michigan from
the
East Coast.
And we're glad you moved here.
I am too. as an aside note, I met my wife here, and I'm living happily ever after. So
you'll stay out of trouble with that statement, yeah. Your wife
indeed.
Listens.
Hopefully she'll be listening. So my point is that in 1994, when DWJ was established, we were established because there was a huge need for people to learn more about the state of affairs. And to be honest with you, that message wasn't very welcome, particularly in the halls of power in this area. And so we've been working with many people over the years. And one of the things I'm very excited about is the breadth of the coalition of partners who participated with us on this agenda and continue to support it. And we're looking for more all the time. But my point is that there's been a point in time where, for example, one of our mayors was a national leader among mayors, and he supported a resolution against environmental justice, right? There was so much contention around our issues and what people believe would be harmful to the economy, dynamics with the big 3 industries and others. We've really come a long way collectively, yep, as a society, and particularly in our region. And so it was very exciting to me to be in the room with representatives from the city council who were enthusiastic about the vision and how important it is to them that Detroit be known as a place to go, a place to live, a place to come and raise a family and have a healthy, clean environment and a vibrant economy, like that. All those things go hand in hand.
Well, the Detroit environmental agenda is a bold statement, and I congratulate you and all the collaborators for putting that together. And one has to feel optimistic about the initial response. I imagine now some of the really hard work, the details, come next.
Oh, absolutely. President Brenda Jones of the council encouraged us to convene a larger group that had all parties that we see as crucial to advancing the agenda, to bring the business sector, the mayor's staff, a greater section of the public, academia, and so forth. And so we're now feverishly planning a follow-up event that we're hoping to pull off sometime maybe in mid-June. And my colleague Kimberly Hill Knott, our policy director, and I will be up at Mackinac, and we'll be talking to as many people as we can get to listen.
Absolutely.
About this, because we really feel that this agenda is a crucial part of Detroit's future. We'll help it manifest new components in the charter. It'll help bring more cohesion and a stronger voice around grassroots efforts in the city. I mean, we have a city that has an amazing history of self-determination, and particularly in the African-American community, and that's a voice that seems to not be getting the attention and sway and support that we feel is warranted. So that's another perspective that doesn't come out that way in the agenda, but we feel that we're trying to create a policy arena that will let all of the great ideas rise in a less fettered fashion.
Well, it's called the Detroit Environmental Agenda. Guy, please keep us posted, and as things move along, I mean, maybe we can do an annual update on how things are going in terms of the implementation of the Detroit Environmental Agenda. I've been talking with Guy Williams. He's the president and CEO of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice, one of the organizations responsible for developing that agenda. Guy, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you, Kirk. Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, burn it up, so you know, radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Making a Michigan State University education accessible to all is a key pillar of President Simon's Boulder by Design initiative. And that's why MSU Alumni Association chapters around the world raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship money each year. Our members share our belief that the same educational experiences we enjoyed should be available to future generations of Spartans. That's why we support MSU's innovative Grandparents University, where you and your grandchild can learn from some of Michigan State's most gifted professors. It's why we touch thousands of lives each year with our career enrichment seminars. And it's why MSU Alumni Association chapters are among the first to welcome new students at dozens of annual freshman family picnics in every city from Detroit to D.C. The MSU Alumni Association was founded to add Spartan value throughout your Spartan life. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.